I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you want to be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
Beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast, where we're joined once again, Jack. It's been very regular in the last few weeks by
it's a pleasure.
Jack Howard. The most recent set of discussions that we had, well, I mean, the reason that Jack has been such a frequent visitor is that we had one podcast. We sat down to do two podcasts. One of them was going to be the one that we're going to do today, which is we decided to choose our top five Pixar movies. But the one before that was a Christopher Nolan top 10. We said we'll do that in one podcast. It ended up taking three podcasts to do it, partly because one entire podcast was taken up by Jack getting off his bike about one of my choices. If you haven't had a chance to enjoy those podcasts, do go back because they're feisty, aren't they, Jack?
They are quite feisty. Yeah, we get a bit more personal than we usually get. There's a lot of like name calling. There's a lot of flappy hands.
I want to be quite clear about this. When you say we get a bit more personal, no. You get a bit more personal.
I'm not sure.
In the past, I have been accused of getting a bit snappy with you, which incidentally I think is all in good fun. But like, it was I've never seen you quite so riled as when you discovered where I'd put Dark Knight in
my top 10. Really, it really bothered me. So if you want to hear that reaction and see my reaction,
really
Kermode on Film Patreon page.
Yeah, go to the Patreon page. You can see Jack losing his shit.
So I've started to think that maybe you put it there just to get a rile out of me. I think that like you don't even believe what you've said. You've just done it to piss me off.
No, well, okay, but here's the really funny thing, because I'm recording this in my shoe cupboard, you know, and the rest of the house is obviously on the other side of that door. And the door in the shoe cupboard is just like, you know, some planks bolted together. There's no soundproofing. And child two, who you know as well, went, did I hear you right? And I went, what? He went, did I hear what I think I heard you say? And I went, well, I don't know. What did you think? He said, what are you talking about? So it's like, fine. So I literally sat here in my room getting it in one ear from you, and then I go outside and I get it in the other ear from him.
Well, me and child two, you know, we're thick as thieves. Like we're working together on this. Like I won't rest until the end of this podcast. When we finish this podcast, the last episode ever will be you admitting that The Dark Knight is better than The Dark Knight Rises, and that the end of The Dark Knight Rises is not a dream.
yeah, that's not going to happen. But anyway, my suspicion is that this week's will be less testy, but also, you know, just as much fun. So we decided to do our top five Pixar films. Looking back over the Pixar catalog, the thing that's kind of slightly heartbreaking is all the things that you have to leave out. Because if you're only picking five, and incidentally, we decided, just clear this up at the beginning, we're not including short films, are we?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say that. That makes it too difficult.
And also, we could almost do a top five Pixar short films.
Well, if the demand is there,
because actually I was in my original list, I had a couple of shows and I went, oh no, for heaven's sake, I can't have a short film. They actually have to be features. So top five Pixar features. And it was quite painful because even the Pixar films that I'm not crazy about, it felt painful to leave them out. So the way we're going to do this is we'll count down our top five, starting from five. And if you choose one that I've got coming up, I'll say, oh, no, okay, I've got that coming up at number three or whatever, and we'll hold off the discussion until then. Okay. Otherwise, if you choose one that only one of us has got, we'll then do it there and then. Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me.
Okay. So, Jack, I'm going to ask you to kick off and say, what is your number five most favorite Pixar feature?
My number five favorite Pixar feature is Inside Out.
Okay, so I have got that in my top five. So
I know you do, and I know exactly where it is.
You know, there's a kind of... Simon Mayo did this thing. He said, I know what you think about something from the pause between when I ask what you think about something and the thing, and it really bothered me. Yeah, but the thing is, the longer I go on, the more I realize that I am completely predictable. So,
but it's not even that you're completely predictable. It's the fact that, like, I know you well enough. And I also remember very well that in 2015, you said Inside Out was your favorite film of the year. So okay. I can imagine it's going to be pretty high.
Let's try and build some tension into this. You know, will it still be there? Will it? Ooh. Okay. So at number five, I have WALL-E.
Okay. I don't have WALL-E in my list.
Okay,
and I think, actually, I'm glad that we're kicking off with this, because I think that my opinion on WALL-E, or WALL-E, however you want to pronounce it, is maybe my most controversial and annoying opinion out of all of my opinion on cinema, because I don't particularly like WALL-E that much.
Okay.
And I think that WALL-E is held up as like one of the greatest films of all time, you know, especially in the 21st century. And I just don't particularly like gel with it.
Okay, so here's my take on WALL-E. I'm putting WALL-E in there for the first movement. I actually am not crazy about everything that happens after the first movement of WALL-E. But I think the first movement is so beautiful that I'm putting it in. So essentially, I know this sounds crazy, but I'm including in my list of my top five favorite Pixar movies a film which I think is deeply flawed, but has a section in it that is so great that it kind of knocks the rest of it out of the ballpark. And the thing
I actually
thought we
would disagree on this a bit more, but it actually feels like we are kind of on a similar page on this.
Yeah.
I think that this film is beautifully photographed, if that's what you can call it with an animated film, but like the cinematography in it is unlike anything, and the subject matter and the way that it's told is maybe one of Pixar's most mature, but there's something about it that I don't feel charmed by it a lot of the time. And some of the thematic stuff I think is a little bit obvious. And I know it's a kid's film, but I don't know, like, I think we'll come to talk about Inside Out. I think that explores thematic stuff that in a way that isn't as obvious. And I don't know, there's something about WALL-E that has just never gelled with me. And I think it feels like you have a similar opinion on that.
Well, the thing I love about it is firstly, that first act, I got a lot of stuff. I said, you know, the interesting thing is the first act of WALL-E is, to me, firstly, it reminds me of silent cinema. And a bunch of people said, oh, how can you say that? It's because sound effects are really, really important. Yeah, the sound effects are really important. Firstly, silent cinema was never silent. Silent cinema always had music performed with it. And incidentally, some silent cinema had music with sound effects. I suppose if you're going to be purist about it, the phrase that I should be using is dialogue-free cinema. I remember Mike Figgis, I've said this a million times, Mike Figgis once said, he told me this story that, you know, when immigrants would arrive in America, they would get off the boat at Ellis Island and they would be shown a silent film of life in New York to prepare them for life in New York. And he said it was a universal language of film, it was visual language. And he said, and then the minute that the talkies arrived, the minute you had synchronized sound and dialogue, that universality of silent cinema, which was never silent, went away. So we had a very interesting discussion. And I'm a huge fan of silent cinema, and I play in a band that accompany, I'm wearing the t-shirt, but that accompany silent movies.
Do you really think that, in a band, Mark?
I know, I should mention it more. But not everybody does love silent cinema, and I do. And it's something which I always come back to. I love the physicality of silent cinema, and I love how physical WALL-E feels. And the other thing, of course, that first movement of WALL-E feels. The other thing, of course, is that WALL-E is essentially, in that first movement, riffing on Silent Running. And so, I mean, if I turn behind me here, you know, this is my Silent Running drone, of which I have my three little models. And funnily enough, I found a guy who makes life-size drones, and And he's invited me to go and look at, he's got these life-size drones, you know, the Huey, Dewey and Louie. And he sent me photographs of them. And I'm already brokenhearted at the prospect of going to visit these drones. And the
I can imagine that's going to be quite emotional for you to go.
Yeah, it's already emotional. I haven't even been there yet.
Yeah.
And Wall-E for me has absolutely got that quality in it. And I remember reading an interview with Laura Dern in which Laura Dern was talking about how much, you know, to the creators of Wall-E, how much Silent Running, because obviously Laura Dern is the daughter of Bruce Dern, who is the star of Silent Running. And that film has such a great weight for me. And I think that what Wall-E does is to borrow from it without ripping it off. And I think that's always the greatest homage, is that, you know, you can take something, you can take an idea, you can take a quality from something, and you don't rip it off. I do think that everything after that first movement is not the best Pixar. I think actually there are whole sections of it that I agree with you thematically. It's a bit on the nose. But I think for that opening movement, I just, the physicality of it, I know it's animation. I do understand, you know, despite having had this explained to me.
What?
You know, yeah, I know it's not real. It's animation. I don't mean by you, incidentally. I'm referring to an interview with the makers of Anomalisa, who explained to me that cinema is a collection of still images that give the illusion of motion. That changed my view of everything. I know. Wow.
Yeah, I know. I know that he can be a bit.
He can be a bit. Yeah. Anyway, for the strength of that first act, that's Wall-E. Now, tell me what you don't like about it, because I suspect that I'll agree with a lot of it.
Yeah, I think that, like I say, a lot of the thematic stuff is very on the nose. I also this is what I mean about it being an annoying opinion. I don't find myself being particularly charmed by Wall-E and Eve. Which I don't think many people do agree with. I think they find them adorable. Sometimes I do, but sometimes I just find it a bit, I don't know. And also I find myself just, and I hate this as well. I can't find any other way of expressing it. I just find it a bit boring sometimes. but I agree. I think that like there's a lot of strength in it. I also really like going from the live action human beings as they evolve and almost, I suppose, devolve into animated, and that being like having a narrative reason as to why that's happening, that like they're becoming simplified versions of themselves. Like, I like that as a choice. But I don't know. I think the simplest way of expressing it is that it just has never connected with me. It just misses me in some way. Yeah. And everyone else seems to hold it up so high. And I think that makes me just want to shout, it's overrated. But I also can see the value in it. I just don't feel it.
Yeah. I don't have a problem with any of that at all. I think that all those criticisms are valid. But do you like that opening section?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think actually the stuff that comes after it feels a little bit less serious, and it feels like it's you know, it is ripping on things like 2001, like the villain is essentially Hal. I like that they aren't shy about like Wall-E has been built by Apple. Like, he just has the same noise that Apple computers have when he turns on, and I like that they're not hiding that. And all the music choices are very similar to 2001, especially when the captain takes down the essentially Hal. He takes, I think his name's Auto. The music
Siri,
is that.
I think. Okay, but this is fine. So I think, weirdly enough, although it isn't in your list, it's at 5 in mine. I think actually we're on the same page about it.
Yeah.
I was talking before about the short films. I think I would love Wall-E more if it was just a short film,
a half an hour
short with the first movement.
I think you're
right. And then everything else, I can take or leave, but for that first movement, I'm gonna have it in there.
Okay. That is maybe one of the most the best ways of describing it, but maybe it's kind of insulting, is that Wall-E to me feels like a short film stretched out to a feature film, when it maybe would have been more effective as a short. You're right.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like I said again, it's like we're talking about the Nolans. When you're, because the bar with Pixar is very, very high. Mm-hmm. I mean, with some, there are some exceptions, but you know, for it to be a flawed Pixar film, I think that's still fine.
Wall-E.
let's move on to number four. What's your number four choice?
Monsters, Inc.
Okay, so I have Monsters, Inc. as well. Mm-hmm. So we'll hold off on that at the moment. So my number four choice is The Incredibles 2.
Oh, that is, to me, very controversial. Because okay. I have The Incredibles in there. I won't say where. We're going to leave some suspense.
Okay.
I really didn't gel with The Incredibles 2 at all. But please go ahead. Take it away.
Well, I didn't really gel with The Incredibles. I was one of the people who complained that The Incredibles was too long. And I remember writing a review of it in which I said that, you know, there were, I think I may have been quoting the makers anyway, saying that, you know, there are kind of like Bergman-esque silences in it. And there are long, long periods in which it proves quite patience testing. And I always thought, and I have seen it a few times since then, and I've, you know, learned to like it more, but I always thought that the pacing in The Incredibles was an issue. Incredibles 2 just took off like a rocket. And having gone into Incredibles with very high expectations and then thought, you know, this is hard work. Incredibles 2 for me was just like, okay, this is what the pacing of the first one should have been like. I loved the design. I loved the way it looked. I loved the jokes. I loved the way in which the narrative, you know, flipped who it was concerned with. I everything about Incredibles 2 was everything that I had wanted The Incredibles to be, but it wasn't. Now, what was your issue with Incredibles 2?
I might need to watch it again. I only saw it the once when it was out in the cinema. And I was in Los Angeles when I saw it as well. And unfortunately, I ran to the cinema and missed the opening short film, which everyone was praising. So I haven't seen that short film, so I'll have to get it on Disney Plus. Spawn, not Spawn. I'll have to watch Incredibles 2 again.
I didn't know what that was until you taught me. This is one of the classic examples of, excuse me, child. What does this mean? I had to look up a thing the other day. Somebody tweeted me a thing which was goat. I did something about Breaking Bad or something. So, okay, you know what goat means, right?
I do.
You know, greatest of all time. I thought they were calling me a goat. I was all set to block them before
you realised it was a compliment.
Before I stopped and looked it up. You know. Anyway,
all capitals, goat.
Yes, exactly.
I remember finding the plot annoying. I remember finding the sort of the way it moved. And the twists and turns a bit obvious and uninspired. I didn't particularly find it funny. I can't really remember much about it. But that's part of it as well. I think it's quite forgettable. I'm going to have to rewatch it and I'll report back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... Let me venture to say something. I've had experience of watching films in America when my head was in the wrong time zone and when I've run to the theater or whatever it was. I saw AI in America in a theater in New York and I really didn't like it. And I didn't watch it again for years until I was told you really need to have a look at this. And I went back and saw it and it was a completely different film. So I think, knowing you as I do, and knowing now that Incredibles is in your list, I think if you went back and revisited Incredibles 2, you might find it to be a better film. In the same way that I thought Incredibles was a better film the second time around. The first time around, I did find I had a pacing issue with it. But we'll get to that when we talk about Incredibles. But I do think Incredibles 2 is really funny, really sharp. I love the way in which it plays with your expectations. I love the pacing of it. I mean, so much of animation is to do with pacing. You know, it's not whether it's long or short. It's to do with how the film moves. And this is true of all cinema. But animation is particularly dependent upon editing and pacing because animation is created, you know, in the room. And it's much harder. Like, If you are somebody who is editing an animated feature, you're basically working all the time with all the creative parts because it is literally happening in the room. It's kind of different to editing live action footage. It's a particular skill. And honestly, I think too little attention is paid to the genius of how well the animated films that we love are edited.
I agree.
Pacing is such a big issue and it's so hard to get right.
I wish I'd... because I actually wasn't expecting this to come up on the list. So I wish I'd rewatched it, because I remember having quite a strong reaction to it. And yeah. I remember listening to your review where you praised it so much. And I was like, what's he talking about? So I remember not agreeing with you. And, yes. and so I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it and see if okay. those feelings are still there.
You look ghastly, Robert.
I haven't been sleeping. I broke my daughter. They keep changing math. We needed AA batteries, but I got AAAs, and now we still need AA batteries. Put one red thing in, a load of whites, and now everything's pink. And I think we need eggs.
Done properly, parenting is a heroic act. Done properly. I am fortunate that it has never afflicted me.
On to number three. What's your number three choice?
The Incredibles.
Okay. So now this isn't in my list. So tell me what you love about The Incredibles.
So it's directed by Brad Bird, who used to be a creative consultant for years on The Simpsons. And I think that some of the humor in the first Incredibles is like basically the best humor that you get in The Simpsons. I think Edna Mode is one of the greatest comedy characters that's ever been created.
I
could quote her all day long. And actually, when I went to Milan, you can okay. see where this is going. All I could say was Milan, darling, Milan. I love the score. It's Michael Giacchino, I think it is. Yeah. The Incredibles. And my composer friend Benjamin Squires told me that they approached John Barry to do The Incredibles because they wanted yeah. an old-fashioned Bond score, but he turned it down because he okay. didn't want to do any more Bond stuff, which is interesting. But I think that the score that you get with that is so close to something like On Her Majesty's Secret Service, it's not even hiding it. The theme for The Incredibles is so close to that theme. I love... Like when I watched The Incredibles as a kid, I didn't take to it as much as you might expect me to, being a massive fan of Bond and a massive fan of superheroes. And yeah. I think it's because the opening sequence is very mature for a kid's film. Like I didn't know what yes. suing somebody was.
No, it absolutely is. And that's what I meant when I said it's a cartoon that's going off into Bergman-esque territory.
Right, right.
It is. And that's absolutely what I meant. I mean, I had visions of people going, what?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that it's
like domestic ennui.
Yeah. Like, as an adult now, I watch it and it's like a superhero is getting sued. It feels like it's ahead of its time in terms of the way that superhero movies are made now. Like, even within the Marvel universe, about how in Civil War and stuff, where the superheroes were sort of rallied against. Mm-hmm. And I think that The Incredibles was kind of ahead of its time. And I love how much it's playing with the ideas of superhero powers reflecting the personalities of the characters. It's an idea that's been done over and over, but I think it works super well. I think all the dynamic is really like exciting and funny, and all the stories tie up so beautifully. It's even things like, again, like the maturity of it, like having somebody who's trying to commit suicide at the beginning. There's even a storyline where Mrs. Incredible believes that her husband is cheating on her for a bit. Like, there's very mature ways of yeah. telling a story, but it just happens yeah. to be animated. And I think I found the first one a lot meatier than the second one, and a lot more honest and like a story they wanted to tell. And Incredibles 2 felt like, oh, we should just do a sequel now. It's been long enough. Yeah, and I like the twist as well. I still really like that to me feels like the ultimate Pixar twist, the one that they've been trying to recreate over and over again, with like somebody that you liked at the start turns out to be the villain at the end. I think it's brilliant, and I think it's visually as well, like the way Brad Bird moves the camera, you know, the camera quote unquote, is really creative. He's clearly got an eye for visuals that, in my opinion, doesn't come across in his live action stuff as much as his animation. Okay. And nor does his storytelling in general. I think he does better when he's able to play around and, you know, Pixar make the movie over and over again until it's right. I think it's great. I think it's almost perfect. I think it's like okay. everybody at the top of their game.
I mean, I agree. So here's the thing. I agree with all the things that you just said about it. The difference was that I found those things off-putting. I did find the, I found that early movement with all those things, you know, with the domesticity thing. I just thought, how is this going to play to kids? Now, that said, I've subsequently seen loads of kids watch Incredibles and actually get loads and loads out of it. Interestingly enough, many of them on third, fourth, fifth viewing, because I still think that on the first time, in the first viewing, there is a pacing issue. But you know, obviously, we now live in a world in which everything is consumed. And of course, when you watch Incredibles on the DVD, the Jack-Jack Attack short is just like unbelievably great.
Yeah, it is.
And actually, for me, I was going, yeah, well, that's what I want. And when I was reviewing, you know, Incredibles 2, I said, that's what you get with Incredibles 2, because I, you know, you watch the Jack-Jack Attack short and you just go, okay, that's just genius. That is absolute, you know, bang on genius. And that's what I thought I was getting from Incredibles 2. But I think you should watch Incredibles 2 again. And I think I should probably watch Incredibles again, because I think that we're agreed on what the qualities are. The question is just how we reacted to those particular.
Yeah. I think actually, what I was going into The Incredibles 2 with was that I've grown to enjoy the maturity of the first one
that I
didn't connect with as much as a kid, that I grew to like as an adult. And actually what you wanted from the first one was the sillier stuff, and you got that in the second one. So yeah, I think actually that's kind of what's happened, is we've both again brought our expectations to something and that's defined it.
This is a hobo suit, darling. You can't be seen in this. I won't allow it. 15 years ago, maybe, but now...
Oh, what do you mean? You designed it.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now. You need a new suit. Don't much is certain.
A new suit? Oh, where the heck am I going to get a new
you
suit?
You can't! It's impossible! I'm far too busy, so ask me now before I again become sane.
Wait, you want to make me a suit?
You push too hard, darling. But I accept. It will be bold. Dramatic.
Yeah.
Heroic.
Yeah, something classic. Like, Dinoguy. Oh, he had a great look. Oh, the cape and the boots.
No capes.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So, did I ask you your number three already?
Yeah, that was The Incredibles.
The Incredibles.
So what's your number three?
So sorry. So my number three, and here we're going to join, is Monsters, Inc.
Right, great. So I've used that as my number four, so let's talk about it.
Okay, so you want to go first on me? Because I went first on Incredibles. You go first on Monsters, Inc.
Monsters, Inc. Is a film that I remember very clearly seeing in the cinema and being wowed by it. It's like that, and actually, weirdly, Prisoner of Azkaban are two of the films I remember walking out of as a kid and being like, wow. Like, not even understanding what cinema had just done, but I'd just been told a story and how emotional it was. And it's the first time I remember like wanting to know what the character's real name was, like that hidden secret. And the way that, you know, it's just, I'm skipping right to the end, but like building the door again, all of that stuff. I think it's this is what the list is all about, but it's up there with Pixar's like perfect films. Like there's nothing wrong with it. And it's got this weird mix of being funny, but also being scary and sad. I think that Sully and Mike are incredible, and it really bothers me. Like Monsters University. Really,
oh, I hate Monsters University.
I hate it so much.
Yeah,
It's one line in Monsters University that ruins. Sorry, it's one line from Monsters, Inc. that I think they completely ruin the whole world building within Monsters University is that in Monsters, Inc., Sully and Mike are talking to each other and he says, "You've been jealous of my good looks since the fourth grade, pal." And then we find out that they met in university. That to me just bothers me. It just bothers me so much. It's like, it feels like you're just ignoring your own, that you've established what they were and you, I got it all in that one moment. Yeah. The voice acting's tip top. It's the music's legendary. The opening sequence just gets you in the mood for it. It's incredible. It's so emotional and it's so funny. And Randall is genuinely creepy. It's brilliant. It's just great. And the creativeness of the sort of the last final sequence when they're going in between all the different doors and stuff like that. It's perfect. There's nothing wrong with it.
So just to pick up on something you said about, you know, one line from Monsters Inc. is spoiled by Monsters University. I understand exactly what you mean about that sort of thing. This is a sidetrack, but I remember interviewing Bill Blatty about Legion, and I said, which is the sequel to The Exorcist that he wrote, the film version, which got sort of messed around. And I said, you know, there's one thing that really bothers me about that. He says, Kinderman says, "I love Father Karras was my best friend. I loved him." And I said, "No, he didn't. They only met once." And I said, "And there's a photograph that you've got in which it's a photograph of Karras and Kinderman, which is signed by Karras, which says, 'Keep checking those Dominicans, Kinderman, Karras,' right?" And I went, "How is that possible? How is that possible, right? I read the book in which they meet and he dies. And at no point do they hang out together. It doesn't happen." And Bill Blatty said, "Yeah, I know. But I said, I had to build up the friendship." And he said, "And who would notice?" And I went, "Me." And he went, "Yeah, other than you."
But that's the thing, is I've never spoken to anybody else about that Monsters Inc. bit. And they've all just, like, and no one's ever been like, "Oh, yeah, you're right." They've been like, "Eh, who cares?" And I'm like, "Yeah, but
no, it matters. It
matters. Like, that's why they wrote it in the first place."
I know. It's just, and, you know, every time I watch that version with that photograph in it, it makes me want to tear my hair. When was that photograph taken? It's not possible, right? There was never a point that photograph was possible. The shorthand version of why I love Monsters, Inc. is, put that thing back where it came for, is the best stage musical I never saw. And I could, honestly, it's for, like, I know it's, you know, end credits and everything, but I could just watch that on a loop forever. That musical is such genius. It's absolutely brilliant. The reason it works is because, firstly, every single part of that musical refers correctly to the story that we've just seen before. They wouldn't mess up the Monsters University line. I love the, you know, "We scare because we care" thing. But what I love most about it is it is the perfect combination. And again, we come back to silent cinema here. It's the perfect combination of sidekick characters, of characters who, when you put them together, they're funny because one of them's that and one of them's that, you know? And the genius of, you know, when he gets shown the magazine, when he's, and it's got the stat.
"I'm on the cover of a magazine."
And it's just that absolute, the joy of that, the delight of it, the wittiness of the voices for a start. I mean,
I love, I'm sure you know this, that Billy Crystal was offered Woody and turned it down.
I didn't know that. No.
Yeah. He was offered Woody, turned it down and said, it's the single biggest regret of his career. And so when they offered him a role in this, he jumped at the opportunity to do it. I love as well that it's, again, it's Pixar dealing with mature themes. It's got a thing about, this is the way we've always done it, so we're going to do it this way. It's about corruption. It's got all sorts of big themes going on in it in terms of, like, this is the way we've always done it, so we're not going to change. Even when they know that not scaring children but making them happy and making them laugh is better for them. Yes. They don't want to change. Like, no. They're set in their ways.
But also, I like the idea that children kind of like to be scared. I love all the stuff about kitty, kitty. I love the thing. I love the end. I love Boo. Mm-hmm. Everything about it. It's just like somebody went, yeah, that's it. Don't now go and make Monsters University.
Yeah.
And
even just you talking about that ending where he just very gently opens that door and you just hear her voice one more time and then it fades to black, just makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
It's just, but do you hear her voice? Doesn't he open the door? Yeah, and he goes, boo.
And she goes, kitty. And then it fades to black.
Oh, you know, you're, yes. Anyway, it's just genius.
And then
it's
also, genius. We haven't even mentioned this as well. The outtakes at the end of Pixar.
Oh, yes.
Kind of stopped doing now. But like the bits where like they're falling over during the slow motion walk and things like that. It's just incredible.
What's the name of the character who kind of looks like a great big triangle with the glasses? The one in charge.
Oh, you know, Mars.
Fine. Yeah. So many people have sent photographs of me and
brilliant
that character. And
brilliant.
That's what I look like. And believe me,
Wazowski, you didn't do your paperwork last night.
Exactly. So apparently that's me, that character, and the grandfather in Up. That apparently is me. I spent my whole life wanting to be James Dean. I turn out to be the grandfather in Up or
Mars.
So thanks very much. It's, you know, but I still love the film.
Chalubi, baby. Good morning, Roz, my succulent little garden snail. And who would we be scaring today?
Wazowski, you didn't file your paperwork last night.
Oh, that darn paperwork. Wouldn't it be easier if it all just blew away?
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
I'm watching you, Wazowski. Always watching.
Whew, she's nuts.
Moving on to number two. What's your number two choice?
Finding Nemo.
Ooh. So I don't have Finding Nemo, so go ahead.
Okay, I think Finding Nemo is so, actually, just to put it into context for how I feel about it recently, is that there's another podcast. I'm sorry to do promotion for another podcast on this podcast, but I think I've spoken about it before. There's a podcast called Script Notes, which is, as they describe it, it's a podcast for screenwriters and people who are interested in screenwriting. And there's an episode where Craig Mazin, who wrote Chernobyl and the Hangover sequels, but I don't think he likes that being mentioned. but Craig Mazin just does a solo episode called How to Write a Movie, and he uses Finding Nemo as like a perfect example of story structure and character arc and things like that. And not only just like, this is how it works, but also why do we care about this? And talking about how the writers are basically God putting the protagonist through a series of tests so that he will learn something, and how he's the perfect protagonist for this particular story. Like how Marlin is the perfect protagonist for Finding Nemo. And the example he gives is, you know, just the beginning of, okay, how do you've got an overprotective parent. How do you make us care about his journey? Well, okay. So he's not only does his wife and all of his children get killed, but also his last remaining child is disabled. And that, of course, he's scared of the ocean. It's not just saying, you're a parent, you care about your kids. Of course, if the kid's gone missing, you're going to go find it. They make him so afraid of the wider ocean. And then I think that a lot of the imagery and a lot of the stuff that goes on in it, again, is the stuff I'm kind of obsessed with right now, that it's all an internal thing for Marlin. So, for example, when the fish tell him to go through the cavern or whatever it is, the dark cave, instead of going over it, he ignores that because he goes, oh, it's so much brighter and so much easier up here. And then obviously all those jellyfish descend.
Yeah.
And that,
which is actually really scary.
It's incredibly scary. And that moment there for me is like, you need to go through the darkness and come out the other side. Otherwise, if you're going to keep avoiding it, stuff is going to keep, you're never going to get over your problems. And if you rewatch Finding Nemo, every single scene, there is a problem that needs to be solved constantly. And there is always something that's challenging Marlin. And the same as well with the side story with Nemo and all the fish tank stuff, which also is incredibly funny. I love all that sort of shark tank, hoo-ha-ha. Like, I love all that stuff and the bubbles and this is my sister Flo. Like, it feels like everybody's just so rich. I think it's incredible. And that's not even mentioning as well how funny Dory and Marlin are as two characters. Again, it's that classic duo of the funny and the straight man type combination.
And where did you stand on the sequel?
I thought it was fine. I thought it was okay. Again, it feels like they're shoehorning it in. I you know, it's there's one line in Finding Nemo when she goes like something about her family and she says, "Where are they? Can I help you?" And she just goes back. She just forgets, obviously. And I think that building on a brand rather than actually having a really meaningful story to tell. And it also has Finding Dory has like my least favorite thing that Pixar have come to do since Toy Story did it, which is, you know, people that shouldn't be driving vehicles end up driving vehicles. So instead of toys driving vehicles, this time you've got fish driving vehicles and an octopus. And it all just gets a bit too absurd, even though it's a cartoon and all the rest of it. I know, I'm a bit of a killjoy, but I just find it a bit too...
I love the fact that your pet hate is things that shouldn't be driving vehicles driving vehicles.
Pixar just do it all the time. It just feels like a thing they lean on. Like it's just like, let's just have some characters drive cars.
Do you know the one movie in which they don't do that? Cars. I always wondered in Cars why it is that a car doesn't get into a car and drive it.
There's always, I don't know who said this joke, but I remember hearing it from my friend Kyan, said that John Lasseter just goes around the Pixar like studio just putting googly eyes on inanimate objects to seeing what the next hit is going to be.
Excuse me! Woo! Little fella? Hello!
Don't be rude, say hi.
Hello.
His son Bingo,
Nemo,
was taken to
Sydney.
Yes, and it's really, really important that we get there as fast as we can. So can you help us out? Come on, little fella. Come on.
Dory, I'm a little fella. I don't think that's a little fella.
Oh, big fella. Big whale. Okay.
Maybe he only speaks whale.
We need
Dory.
To find his son.
What are you doing? Are you sure you speak whale?
Can you?
Okay, well, look, I'm actually not going to disagree with any of that. It wasn't in my top five because it isn't something that struggled. But I think, you know, I don't disagree with anything you've said. I think it is really good. I haven't watched it very much. I've seen it, I think, twice, maybe tops. And it, you know, I think it's, I think you're making a very coherent argument for it. My number two is Toy Story 3.
I think that's a good choice.
So I'm assuming that Toy Story 3 isn't in your top five.
Well, I'm going to ruin something now.
No, because you're going to talk about what your number one is.
I am, yeah.
So don't.
Okay.
Because, you know, I think we'll both spoil the surprise at the same time. Okay. So, the reason that I've got Toy Story 3 in there is, and I was interested that I've got two sequels in my list. Mm-hmm. And I love Toy Story, and I know that we're going to talk about Toy Story in a moment because of what you just said.
Or are we exactly?
Yeah. The genius of Toy Story 3 is, for me, Toy Story 1, 2, and 3 are the perfect trilogy. And that's why Toy Story 4 was always a problem. I don't think Toy Story 4 is a bad film. I think it gets away with it. But I think it's unnecessary. And in an ideal world, it wouldn't exist. I think that Toy Story 1 is great. Toy Story 2, I think, is arguably better. Although it started out as a straight to video production, and it was only halfway through doing their stuff, and somebody said, you know, this is a theatrical release.
Partly as well down to Tom Hanks. Like,
yeah, it was. You know, it was Tom Hanks saying, you know, this is a much better film than you think it is.
And I think they lost a load of animation as well, and they had to redo a lot of stuff. Like it was a pain in the ass, that film.
Yeah. But yet it's so great. I mean, the tour guide Barbie going around the shelves is just, you know, and can I stop smiling now? All that stuff is just
the references to Jurassic Park as well, like dinosaur overboard.
But Toy Story 3 was like, okay, this, you know, we know Godfather 1, great. Godfather 2, greater. Godfather 3, oh dear. Toy Story 1, great. Toy Story 2, greater, arguably, but I think it doesn't matter either way. But Toy Story 3 is the thing that brings the trilogy to a close, and it does it in a way that is as perfect as the end of Winnie the Pooh. And I discussed this on air with Simon Mayo, and we are both grown men who have ended up crying, like genuinely in tears on air, because the thing about Toy Story 3 is it captures that thing about letting go of, and by that point, it's to do with letting go of your own children. And I just think it's so brilliant the way it does that. And also the way that it has that sense of the baton being passed on to the next generation, and the way in which it takes all the strands of the previous films, and it doesn't, there's not a single mistake in the way in which it deals with all of those things. It's funny and it's exciting and it's kinetic. It's got loads of gags and, you know, everything about it is it's just waiting for there to be a fall, and then it isn't. And then it gets to that ending and I'm in pieces. And I saw it in 3D and I was really glad, because I was crying so much that I was really glad that I was wearing stupid glasses so that nobody could see, because I was just in pieces at the end of that film.
Yeah, I was the perfect age in terms of, I was a kid when Toy Story came out, and then I was a, you know, almost an adult when Toy Story 3 came out. And to me, how it felt watching Toy Story 3 was like saying goodbye.
Yeah,
we're all Andy. Like it's like passing it on to somebody else now, and this isn't for us anymore. And letting go of childhood as well is how it felt to me. Letting yourself move on. And I think I'll just transition into my number one and say that my number one, and I'm cheating because otherwise this list would have been boring. My number one is Toy Story as a franchise.
Oh, you see. Okay, fine. That's because I'll buy it.
Otherwise, my top five would have been Toy Story 1 to 4, okay, and then Finding Nemo.
Okay.
Because that franchise, that whole story, I think, so I don't agree that Toy Story 4 is unnecessary. And I think it's also because of the personal connections I have with it. My mom adores the Toy Story films.
Okay.
And there's not many films that my mom will sit and watch. Like she's a quite a difficult cinema partner. and I've had them my entire life. And we saw Toy Story 2 in 1999 in Florida on my first trip out to America. And it was like months and months before it came out in the UK. And then we went to go see it again when it actually came out in February of 2000. I saw it in 1999, and I was like, I must be one of the only kids to have seen Toy Story 2 in the UK. Like I was so like chuffed with myself. And then getting to Toy Story 4, I think that film specifically, in terms of it being Woody's movie, is Woody as the parent letting go of children.
Yeah, the thing with Toy Story 4 is Toy Story 4 is the first of the Toy Story films that's actually about the toys. The first three aren't about the toys.
Yeah.
They're about us. Toy Story 4 is about them. And that is exactly it, that Woody then becomes the parental figure. And I think there are great things in Toy Story. I think it's slightly slow off the mark, but then I think once it gets going, it's great. And I also think
some of the editing in Toy Story 4 is a bit off. Like it's the only time I've really ever noticed like odd editing. It's like there's moments that I can tell they've gone, oh, that doesn't quite work. So I guess we'll have Tim Allen record one more line here. When he goes, how do we get that key? And it then cuts to something else. And I'm like, that wasn't supposed to go like that. I can tell. It's things like that that I find slightly odd. Yeah. But I think in terms of a story, and it's also amazing to see that Toy Story 1 is, what if your toys were alive when you left the room? And then Toy Story 4 is like, they're sentient and they have feelings of like grief and letting go, and they're basically human beings now.
But also, Toy Story 4 has the thing about the creation of, you know, Spoonie or Forky. It's Forky, isn't it?
Yeah.
When there is a thing about what, you know, why? I don't know. You know, it's like how is it?
Yeah.
But Forky and the principle is that, you know, in the previous movies, the life is engendered by our imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, your toys are alive in your imagination. And Forky is the first character to go, why am I alive?
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's so existential.
I know. And it's really funny. I still think it's not perfect.
But it's so interesting as well. Like if you're going to think deeply about it, like Forky is alive. And
is he called Forky or Sporky? Because he's a spork.
He's a spork, but he's called Forky. He's
Forky, right, fine.
But yeah, he's alive. And then his first instinct is to self-destruct. His first instinct is to throw himself away. And it's so interesting.
That's right. Yeah, he keeps jumping in the bin.
Like, it's so interesting that that's like, when you're conscious, that's like inherently what you're bound to try and do is self-destruct in some way. And I think that as well, like, you know, I don't know if they thought, I'm sure they did have conversations about stuff like that, but I think that that in itself is like also very interesting to have in a kid's movie like that.
I remember interviewing Tom Hanks for it and just saying, I'm just so relieved because I was terrified that when I heard they were making it, I was so scared that they were going to mess it up, because it's like, please don't mess this up. Please don't, you know, don't Phantom Menace it. Don't, you know, just don't. All right.
I was so scared. I was so scared sitting down in that cinema and being like, right, okay, you've got the perfect trilogy that everybody agrees is maybe one of the only perfect trilogies. And then you're going to do a fourth, that just to sort of add it on the, that's what you're going to do, is it? You're going to take that risk. And I thought it was just incredible. And some of the funniest gags as well, like Keanu Reeves in it is so funny.
Yeah, he's great.
The G.I. Joe that keeps asking for a high five. That just makes me laugh every time. But also,
the horrible ventriloquist doll who
so scary.
Yeah, see, I've got a thing about ventriloquist dolls anyway, but I mean, it's such a,
And the score is scary as well. It's got one of Randy Newman's worst songs in it, which is the I Can't Let You Throw Yourself Away, which is him just singing that over and over again. And I know he's got simple songs, but You've Got a Friend in Me is a banger, and I Won't Let You Throw Yourself Away, which I think was Oscar nominated. It's just because they're like, oh, have we got any other songs? I guess we'll have to nominate that one. But if I were to pick, if I had to pick out of the four, if that was the situation I was in, I would pick the first one, just because it feels like it started it all. I think that the clash between Woody and Buzz is just a classic. And actually, if I was going to have a criticism of number four, it feels like they simplified Buzz a bit too much. Like, he just becomes an idiot again in number four. I didn't ever felt like that about Buzz since the first one.
One of the weird things about the first Toy Story is I saw a bit of it, an unfinished bit of it that they were showing.
Oh, wow.
As a kind of, no, it's just they were doing a sort of a promotional thing. I mean, obviously, there was a load of people saw it, in which they were showing us how digital animation, 3D digital animation, you know, 2D, but what they call 3D digital animation worked. And I remember looking at it and just thinking, this is the trippiest thing I've ever seen. Mm. I can't, it's really physical, but it's not, it's animation. I'm really, oh, I can't quite get my head around this. And I remember the first time I watched the whole film, the first 5 minutes, I know this sounds absurd now because now we're all so used to it, but the first 5 minutes just going, I can't, what is it? It's not, it looks real. It looks tangibly physical, but it isn't. And we're now all so used to it. We're so used to the idea that animation can do that. But when it first happened, it was really bizarre.
It's also very interesting that it's what we were talking about actually with Nolan when he made Following, that he used his limitations as a positive thing and go, okay, what can I achieve? And that's exactly what Pixar did as well. They were like, okay, we can't make human beings look real yet.
But we can do shiny surfaces.
Yep. So let's do toys.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, if you rewatch the first Toy Story especially, the humans look a bit weird. They're a bit scary looking, like their eyes and all the rest of it doesn't quite work.
But the toys are
incredible. I just think it's perfect from end to end. I'm one of the people that criticized Toy Story 3 for repeating a bit of the plot of Toy Story 2, which is good guy turns out to be bad guy, but
okay,
such a minor criticism. But overall, I think they're just absolutely wonderful.
Oh, here we go. There should be a little hole under the switch.
Little hole. Got it.
To reset your Buzz Lightyear, insert paperclip.
Rex, use your finger. Okay, now what?
All right, let's see. Caution, do not hold button for more than 5 seconds.
It's not my fault.
Bitácora espacial. Me he despertado del hipersueño en un planeta extraño.
Now what did you do?
I just did what you told me.
Estoy rodeado por criaturas extrañas y desconozco sus intenciones.
¿Quién anda ahí? ¿Amigo o enemigo?
Amigos. We're all amigos.
Me debo de haber estrellado y se me ha borrado la memoria. ¿Han visto mi nave espacial?
We gotta switch him back.
So my number one, as you correctly predicted, was Inside Out. And I'll just, I'll do this sort of fairly briefly because it's an uncontroversial opinion. I just remember watching Inside Out and thinking, okay, it's the numbskulls, I know that. But it's just the most brilliant analysis of, of the internal struggles that somebody is going through. And and told in a way that's completely understandable. Part of me sort of thought, I just love this. I think it's great, and I'm really enjoying the cinema. Part of me thought, this is like psychologists could sit for years writing books attempting to explain what this film just explained in less than 2 hours or however long it is. And I also, the genius of a film that understands the nature of sadness and why sadness is important,
especially in a kids' film.
Yeah. And actually talks about it. And, you know, I know this sounds like a really stupid thing to say, but if you have any interest in religion, one of the things that, you know, it's like, why evil, right? Why evil? Well, that's on a par with why sad, you know, and it's like the argument about, you know, nature, wasps. What are wasps for? Well, you know, wasps are actually necessary because there's a whole bunch of things that wasps do that you don't, it's not just that they chase you down the street and sting you. There's a whole thing that they're doing that you don't know about. And I think that in the way that Inside Out deals with a character going through a sort of rite of passage and all the warring emotions that are involved in that is just absolute genius. And I love that film. I just, yeah, you know, on every single level, I thought that was the best film that year. I thought it should.
I think that overall the film is about, it's sad to be okay. It's okay to be sad. It's sad to be okay. it's okay to be sad. And I think that's an amazing thing to have in a kid's film. And I also like very, very much the how drastic it feels and how dramatic it feels when those islands that create her personality end up falling, and how at a loss that feels, but also that it's okay. It's a part of not only growing up, but it's a part of moving forward in your life constantly, that things will shift and change, and that's okay. And there is a small death that happens every time that we go through something, like when we learn something new or we evolve, yeah, yeah, or something changes, those things are going to fall away and new things will spring up in their place. But there is a sadness that needs to happen first. You need to go down to those dark depths in order to come out of it again. And again, just to repeat, I think it's amazing to have that in a kid's film as your story, as your lesson, as your theme. Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's great and one of their best. And I moved it around quite a lot in my list. It was originally at number four, but it's because it's not one of the ones that came out when I was a kid, so it feels like it hasn't got as much of an attachment to me. But I do think it's fantastic from end to end.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I was an old fart when I saw it, but it just worked for me. And I think,
well, you were an old fart when Toy Story came out, so I was barely conscious.
Yeah, no, I mean, I am 58 times as old as you, but you know, I mean, I'm nearly 60. I'm, you know, I think actually it speaks very highly of Inside Out that for an old fart like me, I just kind of felt like, okay.
Well, there must have been part of you as well that resonated entirely with the parents' view of like wanting your kids to be okay. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a famous saying, which is that, you know, when you're a parent, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. And Inside Out is kind of about that. You know, it's about people have to go through things. People, you know, this is how it works. This is how it works. It's you were saying before about Finding Nemo, you know, the thing about going through the cave, and there's, you know, going on a bear hunt, you know, you can't go over it, you can't go around it, you've got to go through it, which has actually, funnily enough, become kind of a mantra, regardless of everything that's going on. And I'll just bring this to an end, because I realize we've gone over the hour mark, but I'll just bring this to an end by saying, isn't it interesting that in our just discussion of, you know, all lists are essentially silly, but in our discussion of a series of animated films, what we've really been talking about is, you know, life, the universe and everything, and growing up and saying goodbye to things. And you know, I said it before, I'll say it again, it's the fact that an animated feature has never won the Oscar for Best Picture,
yep,
tells you everything you need to know about the Oscars.
Yeah, and there's a reason why we've been talking about that sort of stuff, and there's a reason why all these stories resonate. It doesn't matter that they're drawings on a screen, we connect with them because we know that they're going through something that we all go through, and the best ones connect completely in that way, regardless of what you know, whether or not it's toys or the inside of someone's mind or if they're superheroes or whatever. As long as it's connecting with us on a human level, You know, it's going to take every single story goes back to the bears, like, got to go through it thing. Like, every single story is about someone getting over some form of trauma.
Here we go. All right, open.
This looks new.
Think it's safe?
What is it? Okay, caution. There is a dangerous smell, people. Hold on, what is that?
This is disgust. She basically keeps Riley from being poisoned, physically and socially.
That is not brightly colored or shaped like a dinosaur. Hold on, guys. It's broccoli! Yucky! Well, I just saved our lives. Yeah, you're welcome.
Riley, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not going to get any dessert. Wait, did he just say we couldn't have dessert?
That's anger. He cares very deeply about things being fair.
So that's how you want to play it, old man? No dessert? Oh, sure. We'll eat our dinner right after you eat this.
Riley, here comes an airplane.
Oh. Airplane. We got an airplane, everybody.
Well, Jack, that's been great fun. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you.
If you want to watch a video of this, you can go to the Kermit on Film Patreon page. And we'll be back in the very near... We must at some point in the future do top five Pixar shorts.
Okay.
Because the Pixar shorts are fabulous. Anyway, listen, Jack, that's been really terrific. Thanks ever so much. And I'll see you at the next one, when everything's back to normal, as, of course, it's all going to be really soon.
Yep, definitely. Funny joke to end it on.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.